This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Bob Powell. When you open your mailbox, watch television, or listen to commercial radio in the lead up to the 2018 general election, you and other would-be voters were likely bombarded by political advertisements. Like in elections past, some of the materials were paid for by candidate committees and are easily identified as such. But the sources of materials from other groups, known as independent expenditures and not authorized by a candidate or candidate committee, are often more difficult to discern. Senior reporter Dave Mistich has been looking into these groups. He spoke with Assistant News Director Glennis Board about what he's learned and how getting the full picture on outside spending remains problematic.
So Dave, let's just start with what we know. How much do we know was spent during this election cycle?
Well, you know, that's based on what I was able to track. I can say, you know, confidently that there was at least $5.4 million spent between West Virginia House, Senate, and state Supreme Court races. If you look at the story online, you'll see that there are some groups that were unable to see exactly how much they spent and where they spent it. But, you know, $5.4 million is the number that we're starting with.
There were some independent expenditures that put money towards West Virginia candidates and races. Were these funded by mostly in-state or out-of-state sources? Do we know?
Well, we do know on at least a couple of these. For the Democrats, they were backed by mostly unions, some education unions, as well as, you know, some trade unions. On the Republican side, some of these groups took money from coal companies or other companies that were related to the coal industry. There's also, you know, like national groups. Their money comes from donations from individuals and businesses all across the country. So, you know, there's a mix of that money coming from in-state and some that came from out-of-state.
So you were able to determine that the pro-Democrat groups really outspent Republican groups. But at the end of the day, the majority power in the legislature stayed with the Republicans. Does that mean these groups weren't effective?
Well, you know, I think that depends on who you ask. Of course, you know, a lot of these groups are putting money into just a handful of races, and they came out on top in a few of them and lost or their preferred candidate lost in other situations. But there's other groups that, you know, of course, put money into dozens upon dozens of races. And, you know, I don't think that any of the people behind these groups would have said that they expected to win every last one of them. But, you know, in talking to these people, you know that they're very calculated in the way that they're spending money, the kinds of candidates that they're either opposing or supporting, and the districts that those candidates are from. So, you know, it's really hard to tell based on this money, you know, at the end of the day, to make a final determination whether or not all this is effective.
But it does seem like the money spent in the judicial campaign was pretty effective. Would you agree?
I think that's fair to say. I mean, between Tim Armstead and Evan Jenkins, they received between them more than $2 million from some of these groups. And others would probably say that their appointment by Governor Justice gave them a leg up. But it's hard not to believe that, you know, high dollar TV and online digital ads weren't helpful for them in these races.
So, Dave, let me ask you, did you know a lot about this subject when you started to research the topic?
The short answer is sort of. You know, I'd been taking a look at, you know, one of these groups in particular, the West Virginia's Future PAC, before the election. So I had sort of an idea of where to look for their campaign finance reports. But the more and more that you dig into this, you'll realize that the system on the Secretary of State's website is very not user friendly, so to speak, whenever it comes to looking at these IEs. It's much different than looking at a financial profile of a candidate here in the state of West Virginia. So, you know, it took a lot of time going through these documents and then realizing that there are holes in some of these documents. But in the end, whenever you come to learn that the way these laws work, you know, it definitely gives you a different perspective on the way that all this works.
So based on your experience, do you think that state campaign finance laws need to be changed? Can they be changed?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I mean, I think the one thing that really needs pointed out with this is that that a lot of these candidates, many of them, had benefited one way or another from these independent expenditures, you know, during the election cycle. And so for them to go in there and change the laws to make it easier to track this money, I think is a bit of a catch-22. I think it would take someone very brave to stand up and make this, you know, a priority in the legislature. But I do think that there is certainly a need, you know, in trying to track all this money, seeing where it's coming from and, you know, where it's going for the election. I think there's a need to have some transparency there. But, you know, of course, that's my perspective. And, you know, this is what I'm paying attention to. So that might be a little bit biased, but, you know, we'll see what happens.
Well, Dave Mistich, I really appreciate your diligent work to get to the bottom of this very complicated issue.
Great. Well, hey, thanks.
Again, that was Dave Mistich talking with our assistant news director, Glennis Board, more about how outside groups spend money in West Virginia and their statewide races. Find that story on our website, wvpublic.org. In the weather forecast for the Mountain State, a chance of rain likely today, changing over to freezing rain or snow. In December 2015, with support from the City of Charleston, the Kanawha Charleston Health Department launched a harm reduction program, including a needle exchange. The primary goal was to reduce the risk of needle-borne diseases. The secondary goal was to connect illicit drug users to treatment and recovery services. The program closed a little more than 2 years after it opened amid controversy. During the next week, health reporter Kara Lofton is taking a deep dive into what happened and how the needle exchange's closure affects other community harm reduction programs.
The only thing that remains of the harm reduction program outside the Kanawha Charleston Health Department is a syringe kiosk where people can deposit used hypodermic needles. At its peak, the program served more than 400 people a week, mostly from Kanawha County, but surrounding counties as well, a factor that became a point of contention for many in the city. Outgoing Charleston Mayor Danny Jones has been outspoken on the issue.
It became basically a line of people just to line up to get needles on between 10 o'clock and 4 o'clock on any given Wednesday.
In the months before it closed, Jones publicly called the program a needle mill and mini mall for junkies.
On any given Wednesday, they might have given out 12,000 needles.
Actually, the average number of needles given out during the weekly Wednesday exchange was about 5,000, serving about 190 visitors. That's about 26 needles per person per week. The most needles the program ever gave out in a single week was just over 11,000 to 417 people. While 5,000 may seem like a lot, the average heroin user injects several times a day. So 26 needles a week gets a person about 3 injections a day with a clean needle.
A syringe exchange program really should be called a harm reduction program.
That's Dr. Artis Hoven, an infectious disease specialist with the Kentucky Department of Health. She says harm reduction is an all-encompassing idea to reduce the risk of many things associated with addiction.
Provide naloxone. Provide referral to care for people with substance use disorder. They do HIV and hepatitis C testing. They refer to care for those infected with HIV and hepatitis C.
And in Charleston, it seemed to work. While the Charleston program was open, the city did not see an HIV outbreak. During that same time period, 15 counties in southern West Virginia did have a small HIV outbreak. None of the counties involved had a harm reduction program. Recorded incidents of hepatitis C rates did increase during the course of the program, but so did efforts to test more people.
So we're doing rapid hep C and HIV testing today. It takes about 20 minutes. Would you like to go ahead and get that taken care of while you're here?
But in Charleston, reports of discarded needles in the community began to skyrocket, and people were alarmed.
Needle pickup call. They had a needle that was left in a shopping cart. So I want to see if somebody come pick it up.
Yep, I'll take care of it.
All right, thanks, sir. Appreciate it.
Firefighters reported having to crawl over them while putting out fires in abandoned structures. A local elementary school requested a biohazard container from the city so they could clean up an alley before school. And police officers reported finding huge numbers of syringes on people who were arrested. Both the Fraternal Order of Police and the Charleston Professional Firefighters Association wrote letters to City Council expressing major safety concerns for first responders. Issues might have been exacerbated because the program grew really fast. In the 2 years the program was open, more than 651,000 needles were distributed. Only about 66% of those needles were returned. But according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the risk of contracting HIV is 0.3% for healthcare professionals stuck by needles on the job. Which is why, for outside experts like Peter Davidson from UC California, needle litter is an annoyance, but not the major public health concern an HIV or hepatitis C outbreak would be.
No one in the world has ever obtained HIV by stepping on a needle in the street. Like, needles in the street are a piece of trash. You know, it's not something you want seeing laying in the gutter, but they're not actually a very hazardous object.
In some ways, it doesn't matter what the risk is. If someone finds a dirty needle on a playground or in a shopping mall bathroom, public reaction is strong. And for non-users, any risk of contracting HIV or hepatitis from a dirty needle is too much. But reactively closing a program in the biggest city in the state could have huge public health implications for the region.
And when needle exchange programs like the one in Kanawha County are shut down reactively.
That's former Commissioner for Public Health Rao Gupta in an interview shortly before he left his job.
And those decisions are not in the best interest of the community. I think it plays into the hands of that stigma. And it is more harmful long-term than it is beneficial.
He said it's more harmful because not only are you removing your best tool for preventing needle-borne illnesses, but, as we'll hear later in this series, the closure may impact public perception and support for other harm reduction programs across the state that are trying to open or stay open. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Carol Lofton.
Tomorrow, we'll take a look at an idea the city has for reducing needle litter, why it failed, and how failure ultimately led to the abrupt closure of the Charleston program. Appalachia Health News is a project of Marshall Health, Charleston Area Medical Center, and WVU Medicine. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Glenis Board. I'm Bob Powell.